For years, one 400-pound man raped and murdered in Baltimore, Maryland. A drug and alcohol addict, he also seemed to be a pathological liar. Why did he murder the homeless, the weak, the drug addicted, and sex workers? Was it revenge, or did he do it for the human flesh? Or was it, as he confessed, because he had a passion for the taste of blood and the overwhelming sense of power one gets while taking the life of another? This is Joe Roy Metheny, Death, Drugs, and Dinner. Hey y'all, I'm Chris Calvert.
And I'm her husband, Rob Potter. Welcome to Hitch to Homicide.
For better or worse.
Till death do us part.
Everybody.
Yes, welcome. Copycat.
I just wanted to do it one time.
We do everything together. Even the welcomes.
Even though I just wanted to steal your thunder. I'm sorry. That wasn't very nice.
I love it when you steal my thunder.
There you go. I can do that too. Well, we're glad you're back again with us this week.
Yes, we are.
Wherever you're listening, be sure to like, rate, and review. That helps other people to find us. If you want to be a part of our Facebook group, The In-Laws and Outlaws.
Yes, it's a lot of fun in there.
It is fun. All you got to do is go to Facebook and look up Hitch to Homicide, In-Laws and Outlaws. And
we've actually have some regulars that post stuff in there that's pretty funny.
Oh, everyone loves, let me tell you, true crime fans, we're a different breed. You know, see all the memes where it talks about, you know, you're at a dinner party and you want to talk about Ted Bundy and everyone else is like looking at you like you have three heads.
Right.
I'm the person you would want to sit next to at the dinner party and talk about Ted Bundy. So, you know, we're just like a different, we're a different breed. In fact, you know, I had someone the other night just tell me that they had started listening to the podcast and I was like, I hope it's not too gruesome for you. And she said, oh no, because I turn on true crime at night to lull me to sleep. So if I've ever lulled any of you all to sleep, be sure to come in the In-Laws and Outlaws and tell me so.
Yeah.
If you're going to bed with me and Rob actually now.
Hello.
Let me know if my voice is just lulling you. Hopefully I'm keeping you engaged and you're not falling asleep. But yeah. But go in and join the In-Laws and Outlaws. If you want to suggest a case, you can go to hitchtohomicide.com and there's a place for that. There's just a pull down menu. Really easy. Fill out the form. It helps me to keep track of them. Some of you guys have been instant messaging me and sending me emails. That's great too. I try to keep them all in one spot. There's also a spot where you can suggest a bless your heart.
Yeah.
And this episode's bless your heart is from one of our in-laws and outlaws. So hang on for that one, everybody. Hang on to your hat for that one.
Hold tight.
But I'm going to get started on this case. I didn't know about this case, and I didn't know about Joe Roy Metheny, although I seem to do cases where men have three names. You know, it's like Billy Joe, Jim Bob. This is Joe Roy.
Right.
And they called him Tiny. And if you missed the very opening of the podcast, he is a 400-pound man.
Oh, wow.
So strap it on. There's a lot to this. Before we get started, I want to thank some sources. Murderpedia, All Things Interesting, The Daily Mail, The Baltimore Sun, Ranker.com, Medium.com, iHorror.com, and The Capitol. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
Joseph Roy Metheny was born on March 2, 1953 in Baltimore, Maryland. He grows up in Essex, Maryland, which is just east of Baltimore, but his family also lived in West Virginia growing up too. He's got five brothers and sisters. He had a bit of a rough start in life. According to Joe himself, his father was an abusive alcoholic, and his mother, Jean, didn't give a rat's ass about being a mom. Like the kids basically raised themselves. When he's around 6 years old, his father dies in a car accident in Terre Haute, West Virginia. And according to Joe's mother, the family took his death very hard, as you might imagine.
Of course.
They move back to Baltimore. It's not an easy upbringing. And his mom is usually working two or more jobs. And she's just not around. And I want to say, being a single mom, I was a single mom for years. And one person, even working two jobs, would have a hard time paying for six kids.
I can't imagine.
That's a lot. And I read where she worked as a barmaid, a waitress in the Dundalk area, and a food truck driver taking lunches to workers at the Sparrows Point Shipyard.
Wow.
Because remember, we're in Baltimore.
Right.
You used to live in Baltimore.
Yeah, I sure did. I lived in Cherry Hill.
And there are lots of things that say Calvert on them in Baltimore.
There's really?
Like a Calvert Boulevard, Calvert Road.
I had no idea.
What? Are you serious?
No. None. I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to road names when I was living in Baltimore.
Well, next time anybody's in Baltimore, look for the Calvert sign, because I took my picture under it, of course, about three or four times.
There weren't too many Pottorf signs either.
I don't know, honey. I'm sorry, honey. I don't know that I've ever seen a Pottorf sign. There's Calvert Alcohol. There's Calvert in Baltimore. You got me as your Calvert. What can I say? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Yep. Yeah.
But according to Joe's mama, she did put a roof over all their heads and take care of them as best she could. But Joe's going to tell everyone that his childhood was filled with him house hopping between other families while his mom abandoned them. And his mother does not remember Joe's childhood this way. Not at all. And this isn't the only fact about Joe's life that she's going to dispute.
I'm going to say she didn't get Mother of the Year.
Well, she probably didn't get Mother of the Year, but she never took government assistance.
Oh.
And she never put the kids out. According to her, the kids never went out to other places to stay. They were all under one roof.
Gotcha.
Now, Joe's mom has said that Joe was a pretty good student in school and that if he felt neglected as a kid, it was his own fault. Because Joe painted a picture of them being destitute and living on government assistance, and his mother, Jean, has said that wasn't the case at all. So exactly what I was just saying.
Gotcha.
They were poor and money was tight, but she always provided for Joe and his siblings, and Joe was known as a bright kid and a kind child who was very polite. He was big into yes ma'ams and no ma'ams, yes sir, yes sir.
Okay.
When Joe turns 18 in 1973, he joins the U.S. Army, and he has claimed to have served in the Vietnam War.
Okay.
And Joe did serve in the military, but he wasn't in Vietnam, according to his mom. Hmm. She says that he was stationed in Germany. And I'm already painting a picture of someone who lies to make up their own narrative of their life instead of their real life. Because by the time Joe was out of basic training and stationed somewhere, the U.S.'s involvement in Vietnam was all but over.
Right. Yeah.
But while he's in the service, Joe starts to use heroin and cocaine. And after that, he seldom talks to his mother. And in fact, his mother said, quote, he just kept drifting further and further away. I think the worst thing that ever happened to him was drugs. It's a sad, sad story, end quote. But while he's in the Army, he never wrote home. And although his mother said that he had met a woman while he was stationed in Germany, which is where she says he was stationed, there weren't any Army records available to establish what the truth is. So, which makes you wonder about the other aspects of this case. If you lie about one thing, would you lie about other things too?
Right. Was he lying about his mother? And was she actually nominated for Mother of the Year?
Yeah, maybe she was a fantastic mother working all of these jobs.
Yeah.
Because he says he was in Vietnam. Yeah. His tongue wags at both ends.
Right.
As we say in the South.
Right.
When he was released from the military, he was already a heroin addict, but then he added cocaine to his addiction. Joe hung out in bars. He lived with bands of homeless men in makeshift camps in South Baltimore. He spent all of his money on heroin, crack cocaine, and Southern Comfort.
Wow.
He was picked up for common assault, drunken disorderly conduct, and the occasional barroom fight. So he has a record. But he's known by most people that he works with and to others to be a fun-loving, practical jokester who knew how to make people laugh.
Hmm.
He was polite. And mind you, at this point, he's tipping the scales at about 400 pounds. That's 28 and a half stone for those of you in the UK, because we have a big following over there. So I wanted to let them know 400 pounds, 28 and a half stone.
Thanks, mate. That was more Australian than it was British, but it's the best I could do.
We have fans in Australia, right, too. But finally, Joe gets a job as a truck driver, a long-haul driver. He worked other various jobs, but in 1988, he started working for Joe Stein & Sons. Joe was a driver. He was a forklift operator and just an all-round working in the warehouse kind of guy.
Right.
He was also a strong man for the company. Don't forget, he's 400 pounds. A company that acquired wooden pallets and repaired them for resale.
Okay.
They also called him Tiny. He's 400 pounds. 6'1", 400 pounds. They called him Tiny. I'm not going to call him Tiny, but that was his nickname. They called him Tiny.
Wow.
But this is a company that acquired wooden pallets and repaired them for resale. And this is also a place where envelopes of cash were exchanged and merchandise that had absolutely nothing to do with pallets, like TVs, refrigerators, paper products, food. It all arrived at the loading dock and then just disappeared.
Oops. Just happened to disappear.
Yeah. And while he's working for Stein & Son, they give him a trailer to live in on the property. And that way he can oversee things at night like a night watchman. And the owner, Jack Stein, is an ex-con who supposedly turned his life around while he was in jail, was stealing and using the pallet company as a way station for this stolen merchandise. And Jack was ripping off Solo Paper, GE Industries, Sweetheart Cup, the Knoxell Corporation, and Beverage Capital Corp.
So the fox was protecting the hen house, basically.
Well, this is basically mob stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, however you wanna say it, I mean, this is fencing, basically.
Right,
these
are
stolen goods coming through, and then he's cheating everybody that he does have an actual contract with.
Gotcha.
He used to pay off insiders at all these companies, at the Sweetheart Company, at the Solo Paper, at GE. He would pay off insiders at the company, and he either stole merchandise from them or he shortchanged them in pallets. But this place was also dealing drugs and trafficking guns, and Jack would hire men to beat up anyone who got in the way. And Jack Stein also brought his son Joe into the business. I read an article about this family, and Joe Stein was taught and kind of forced into burglary at the age of 15 or so. His dad is like forcing him to do these things. Like, I read where his dad got out of prison. He's 15 years old. His son's 15 years old. He immediately says, hey, I want you to do these things for me, which was basically slide through these tiny little windows into these pharmacies and steal drugs and money and stuff. He taught his son how to disarm an alarm, just crazy stuff. It was a really interesting article, but it kind of plays into this case. And so I didn't want to not mention it.
So most dads want their son to become doctors or lawyers. But...
And he's teaching him how to steal drugs in a pharmacy in the middle of the night.
Yeah, didn't have much of a chance, did he?
Yeah, because his dad gets out of prison, pretty much forces him into the family business. But then after a few arrests and some time in jail, Joe Stein decided he wanted to turn his life around and he was done with crime. He was, however, working for his father again after some time when his dad got out of prison and had found Jesus.
Oh.
He'd found Jesus. He was turning the corner. He wanted his son to work with him. And so he said, okay, that was great. But it didn't last long, and Joe Stein was in the dark about what was going on at the pallet company. But when he did realize that his dad was stealing from all these big companies, you know, GE, Solo Paper, Sweetheart Cup, well, he goes to the authorities. The son goes to the authorities.
Oh, wow.
And the FBI start watching this whole operation. They've got big plans to take down the dad, Jack Stein, the old man.
Right.
So hold that thought because we're going to come back to it.
Okay.
But this is the guy that in 1988, Joe Metheny takes a job with. Now, this pallet company is pretty secluded. It's near I-95 interstate and the drug and homeless areas. And while Joe is there, he's being his jokester self. He jokes with all the guys that he works with. He gives them a hard time. And one of the other guys who works there, his name was Ellison Carter. Ellison actually joked with Joe one time saying, quote, "Hey, are you burying bodies out there?" end quote, because the pallet company backed up to a wooded area.
Okay.
That's called foreshadowing.
Uh-oh.
Joe, who was 6'1", like I told you, and he's fat strong. It's not like he goes to the gym every day. He's not like running back, you know, or offensive lineman.
It sounds strong. Like he couldn't even get through the door to get to the gym.
Yeah, he's just kind of fat strong, but he's this huge man, and they called him Tiny, and he's a bit intimidating because not only is he a big guy, he has tattoos of teardrops and an upside-down cross on his face.
Uh-oh, we know what that means.
Loose nail, according to Catherine.
No, the teardrop.
Means you've killed somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Now, Joe lives in this trailer on the property, and we're going to revisit that in a sec. But Joe is a drinker. And like his father, I read where he would drink a fifth of Southern Comfort a night.
Holy cow.
Wow. I wrote wow in the margins of my script. But also in 1988, Joe married a fellow drug addict, and soon after, these two have a son. I've also read that she was only his girlfriend, but I couldn't nail either one of them down. But they're all living in this trailer together, so not the perfect situation because they're both drug addicts, but at least there's a roof over the baby's head.
Right.
And then it begins. February 22nd, 1994. Tony Lynn Ingracia, age 28, is found dead. She's strangled and stabbed to death and found at the on-off ramp of I-95 and Caton Avenue. It's very near Stein & Company, the pallet company, where Joe lives. Tony had a history of drug addiction. Her parents were John and Rita. Tony also had a brother, Michael, and I believe, according to her obituary, she had a child. She had a son named Robert.
Okay.
And her father said Tony was, quote, a good girl. She had some problems with drugs, but she was trying to get help, end quote. I don't believe Tony was a prostitute, and in fact, Tony had never been charged with anything, but she was a vulnerable young woman with a drug problem who hung out in the drug culture along Washington Boulevard in Baltimore. And as you're going to see, that is like candy for Joe Metheny. Hmm. These people, these drug addicts who live in this area, even though he's a drug addict himself.
Right.
May 1994, Kathy Ann Magaziner is seen for the last time. She's a 39-year-old sex worker. Joe takes her to his trailer. He strangles her with his hands and then also an extension cord.
Wow.
Quote, "I took the end of the cord, strangled her. She was passed out, and I put the extension cord around her neck and killed her. She was wearing cutoff jeans, white tennis shoes, and a white pullover sweater, and she had a purse with her," end quote.
Hmm.
But Joe has most of her clothes off when he kills her because he's raped her. He rapes her, he kills her, and then he buries her body in a very shallow grave on the property of Stein & Sons,
wow,
the pallet company. And he buries her clothes and her purse in a different location. And he says later that, quote, he basically kicked dirt over the person's clothes.
Man.
And walked away. Now, that was a quote from him. And Joe himself has put the events of his life into words, and I'm going to interject those from here on out. Okay.
Okay.
In July of 1994, Joe came back to the trailer after being away and on the road, and the trailer was empty. Hmm. All his furniture was gone. His wife was gone. His six-year-old son was gone. Joe called her a, quote, a crack addict and a worthless piece of shit, end quote.
Wow.
According to Joe, at the time, he would have paid her to get out of his life, and all she had to do was to, quote, take their son to his mother's house, end quote.
Hmm.
Which surprised me because he's not really in contact with
his mother,
his mom,
yeah,
or his family,
yeah,
right?
Right.
Now, remember, he's already murdered at least one person, probably two women that the authorities are eventually going to know about. Joe's later going to say he started killing in 1976.
Mm.
So take the rest of this story and digest it as you will.
So this was shortly after he was out of the service that he killed his first person?
In 1976, yeah. It would have been right when he came right out of the service.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. But you have to kind of take everything he says
with a grain of salt.
With a grain of salt. Yeah. And I wrote, you know, digest it as you will. And that's called foreshadowing, too.
Bum, bum, bum.
Now, Joe's all alone in the trailer. at Stein & Company on this property. This trailer, he had an extension cord running into the trailer from the main building, and he used this one extension cord to power his stereo, his TV, and his AC.
Wow.
And he slept on a couch.
Okay.
And it's during this time that Joe, according to the other guys that worked at the warehouse, would frequent bars, drink, meet women, and get a weekly $20 blowjob.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay.
I think that was going on way before his old lady left him.
Yeah.
And maybe she left him because of that. Who could say? But there are dead bodies before she leaves him.
Okay.
So maybe he was off getting the $20 honky honky before that, right?
Right.
By the end of 1994, Joe discovers that his wife had moved to the other side of Baltimore and was living with a man who was pimping her out for drugs.
Wow.
When these two, the ex and her new man, get picked up by police, Joe's son is placed in foster care.
Okay.
Quote, I found out about 6 months later she had moved on to the other side of town with some asshole that had her out selling her ass for drugs. They got busted for drugs and they took my son away from them for child neglect and child abuse. I had no chance of going to social services and trying to get my son back due to my past criminal record. So I took it upon myself with the hatred I had for these two who lost my son to go looking for them. I found out from someone that they was going under that bridge and getting high with some homeless who lived under that bridge, end quote.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
Yeah. It's November 1994. Remember Kathy Ann Magaziner? Well, he'd raped and strangled her and buried her in a shallow grave at the pallet company. It's been 6 months since he murdered her, and he goes back to her, uncovers her, takes her head, throws it in a box and puts it in the trash. There are other accounts that say he didn't just dig her up and take her head, that he dug her up and had sex with her head and then put it in a box and then threw it away.
This is one sick guy.
This is one sick guy. But Joe's right. With his zero chance of going to social services to get his kid back, he's just enraged. And then he starts looking for the two of them, his wife and the boyfriend. August 1st, 1995, Joe goes under the Hanover Street Bridge to question the drug addicts and the sex workers there about the whereabouts of his wife. And he finds Randall Brewer and Randy Piker, two homeless men.
Okay.
They're both 33 years old. They live in the Patasko Avenue homeless camp called Tent City.
Okay.
Quote, I went under there looking for them, meaning his wife and her boyfriend. They were not there, but the two homeless they got high with were down there. They were passed out on some old stinking mattress, end quote.
Nice.
After Joe gets high with Randall and Randy, he murders them both.
Oh, wow.
He bludgeoned them both with an axe, landing blows to both of their heads, nearly decapitating them both. Jeez. And then he piled them on top of each other on the mattress and walked away.
Jeez.
Then he lures what he called another, quote, crack whore, end quote, under that same bridge in the same night.
Wow.
He questions her about the whereabouts of his wife and her new boyfriend. He gets her high, and then he asks the same questions. Do you know where she is? Do you know where he is? And when she tells him that she doesn't know, quote, I beat the hell out of her and raped her ass and then killed her. I put her in some bushes and went out and lured a second bitch down there, end quote.
Wow.
So he's killed two homeless men, two drug addicts. Then he lures another woman down under the bridge where he's just killed Randy and Randall. He gets her high, and when she can't tell him anything, he rapes and kills her too, throws her body in the bushes. We don't have her name. She's a Jane Doe, because you know I always like to give victims names.
Right.
But then he lures another woman, another Jane Doe. Quote, I did the same to her as the last one. But as I was about to throw her into the bushes with the other one, I noticed an old man down by the river fishing, looking back up at me.
Wow.
End quote.
Not a good time to be fishing.
Joe sees this guy fishing nearby. It's Baltimore, right? I mean, people fish. Yeah. And Joe makes the assumption the guy who's minding his own business and fishing saw everything. So he tracks him down, takes a random steel pipe that he finds, and he hits him in the head. And apparently it was one fatal blow.
Wow.
Quote, I grabbed a steel pipe that was laying by and ran down on him and laid his head wide open. So I put the two girls and him in the river and weighed them down with rocks. That was a very busy night for me. Five murders within about 7 hours.
End quote. Wow.
Joe then washes up in the river, cleans up the crime scene as much as he can, and then he leaves like nothing ever happened. Move along.
Nothing to see here.
Exactly. But after Joe is gone, another homeless man named Larry Amos finds the axe that Joe used to bludgeon Randy and Randall to death, and he murders a man named Everett McDowell. Lots going on under the bridge in Tent City that night.
Yeah, he's a busy boy.
He's a busy guy, but then he leaves the axe behind, and another homeless man picks it up and kills yet one more person.
Gee whiz.
So after 2 weeks, two of the murders are traced back to Joe, which led to his arrest. It was the two guys, Randy and Randall. And the people in the homeless camp, they knew who Joe was. They give him up to the police. But they also arrested Larry Amos, the guy who murdered Everett McDowell the same night with the same axe after Joe leaves it behind.
That's the homeless guy.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And I need
a program to...
I'm telling you. And I didn't mention, but the axe was actually hidden under the mattress where Randy and Randall were to begin with. So I can only assume that that was like their protection.
Yeah.
They're on this mattress sleeping, and underneath it, they have this axe because that's what they use for protection. Joe spends 18 months in Baltimore City Jail waiting for his trial. But when he goes to trial, his defense attorney shows the court that there were lots of disputes between rival groups of homeless people. And Larry Amos had also been arrested, and he pleaded to a lesser charge of manslaughter and was released after serving 1 year and 9 months of his 8-year sentence.
What?
He killed a homeless man with an axe. This is the other guy under the bridge that night.
Wow.
Kills a homeless man with an axe and gets an 8-year sentence and is released after serving 1 year and 9 months. And when Joe's trial rolls around, the jury isn't so convinced that Joe was the guy who killed Randy and Randall.
Why?
Because the other guy was there. Larry Amos was there.
So he's guilty by association.
Yeah. If he killed that guy and said he killed that guy, and it was with an axe, and these other two have been killed with an axe. And of course, according to Joe, he weighted everybody else down and threw them in the river, both women and the guy who was fishing.
Right.
So he got rid of those bodies.
Wow.
In Baltimore Circuit Court, the jury sent Judge Clifton J. Gordy a note during deliberations that suggested that they thought another homeless man was responsible for the killings. They thought that Larry Amos had killed Randall and Randy, and so Joe Metheny is found not guilty. He's acquitted.
Wow.
Now, later Joe is going to claim that he committed the killings of Randy and Randall after this night of drinking beer so that he could take $300 from one of the men. And nobody knows if that's true or not because, hang on, you're going to hear this story a little bit later, but he's basically acquitted due to lack of evidence. And I just want to state now that Joe is such a liar. I said at the very beginning that I think he's a pathological liar. Like, he lies so much, he would have to hire someone to call in his own dogs. He's that guy, right?
Yeah. Well, and the fact that a homeless guy would have $300 that's a drug addict, I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, I realize I'm sure they get like a government check or whatever.
Yeah, but if they're addicted to drugs, they're...
It's gone pretty fast.
Yeah, I watch enough of those shows to know that that stuff doesn't last very long.
He watches enough of those shows. He knows. He watches those shows.
I'm an expert.
So he's acquitted on lack of evidence. And when he's out of jail, guess who offers him a job again?
Who?
Stein and Sons, the pallet company. They offer him a job all over again. Jack Stein, who's still stealing from everyone he can. Joe moves back into the trailer with the extension cord at the back and his co-workers cutting up and laughing and making jokes with Tiny. He's hanging out at the local bars. He's drinking heavily, using drugs, getting his $20 blowjobs, which are probably $30 at this point because he's been out for 2 years.
And, you know, inflation, you know.
Quote, I was free again. I went back. I talked to my old boss into giving me my job back at the pallet company. There was a little trailer on the property, so I told my boss to let me stay there and I'd keep an eye on the place. He agreed to this and he gave me the keys to the front gate and the main building. The company was on a dead-end road. It was very isolated. It was perfect for what I wanted to do.
It's a killing.
End quote.
Yeah, it's a killing spree.
Joe would lure sex workers to his home with the prospect of doing drugs. Then he would strangle and dismember them. Then he would put the meaty parts of the victims' bodies into Tupperware bowls and put them in the freezer. He buried the parts he didn't want to keep in shallow graves, mostly behind the pallet company.
I have to ask, why was he keeping the meaty parts? And please say he's not going to eat these things.
He's probably not, but hang on.
Oh, jeez.
Quote, I lured two more crack whores up to my trailer. I killed and butchered their bodies up. I cut the meat and put it in some Tupperware bowls and put it in the freezer. I buried the remains in several shallow graves in a little woods behind the company. Over the next couple of weeks on the weekends, I opened up a little open pit beef stand. I had real roast beef and pork sandwiches, and why not? They were very good. The human body tastes very similar to pork. If you mix it all together, no one can tell the difference. End quote.
Wow.
So for weeks after luring these women into his trailer, getting them high, raping them, killing them, dismembering their bodies, putting the meaty parts into Tupperware, he decides, I'm going to be an entrepreneur. I'm going to open this little roadside barbecue place. And I read that it was barbecue, and I thought, okay, in the South, we call barbecue something completely different than someone in Baltimore would call barbecue.
Right.
I think when they say they're barbecuing in the North, and y'all can call me out on this if you want, it's like hot dogs and hamburgers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Barbecue in the South, we got the smoker going, you got some ribs, some pork butt. It's barbecue, barbecue. But he had a roadside restaurant.
Wow.
And he's mixing human flesh in with beef and pork.
How disconnected do you have to be from reality to be able to pull this off? I mean, that's just beyond comprehension.
And it was totally fine with him.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And I read it, and in the margins for my notes, I actually have one word written, ooh. Ooh. But let's talk about the pallet company again, Stein and Sons. Because remember the son, Joe, doesn't want to do any more bad deeds for his dad.
Right.
And he's going to go to the FBI and say, look it, I'll tell you everything that's going on, but I don't want to go back to jail.
Right.
And Joe Stein has no idea what's also been going down on the property of the pallet company. And it's not just the fencing and the stealing, but there are bodies on this property now, right?
Yeah.
But he doesn't know that. And the FBI, who is now watching every move of Jack Stein, the older guy, they don't know that either. There's a serial killer right under the FBI's nose. There are bodies right under their nose. No one is the wiser.
Wow.
One of those victims, Kimberly Spicer. November 11th, 1996, just months after Joe is acquitted, Kim Spicer, who's living with her mother on Huron Street, she has a fight with her mom that night, November 11th. Kim had been very upset over the recent death of her brother, who had died on November 2nd of a heroin overdose in an abandoned roadhouse on Wilkins Avenue. And according to Kim's mom, she and Kim would have arguments, but Kim would leave angry, but she would always come back. Quote, she must have run into him on the boulevard, end quote, meaning Joe. And where Kim actually met him was the Borderline Bar in Arbutus, Maryland, which is a suburb of Baltimore. And Joe takes Kim to his trailer. They get high. He beats her. He rapes her. He kills her. But he doesn't necessarily bury her. He sort of places her body under a bunch of pallets. Hmm. He doesn't even bury her body. He doesn't even kick dirt over her body. He just sort of puts her under a stack of pallets.
He's getting careless now.
Then a few days later, Joe and his co-worker, Clinton Ashbrook, are boozing it up and doing lines of cocaine when Joe tells Clinton, hey, I need help moving a body.
Oh, gee. Well, okay.
Now, what would you do if one of your friends was like, hey, I need help moving a body?
Well, first I'd laugh at him because I wouldn't believe him.
Well, Clinton doesn't really believe him either.
Yeah.
And he's kind of freaked out, especially when Joe takes him out and shows him the corpse.
Good grief.
Then Clinton is really freaked out. Now, Clinton just happens to be the brother-in-law of Joe Stein, the son who's got the FBI watching his dad, okay?
Right, right.
And Clinton tells Joe, hey, we have a problem here.
Houston, we have a problem.
Yeah, Tiny over there wanted me to help him relocate a body.
Wow.
Like, what the actual hell, man? I mean, what?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So Joe tells the FBI, who is a whole year into this organized crime situation, and now they have unrelated dead bodies. And honestly, I've read the report, and the FBI's a little pissed because Joe, Tiny, Metheny, he's screwing up their long game, their long game sting.
What?
Yeah, because they have all these plans to take down this whole organized crime thing, and now they got a serial killer who's up for him. But they have to take the idea seriously that there's also an unrelated and or possibly related serial killer now at the pallet company.
Right.
So the FBI tells Clinton, hey, we need you to wear a wire. We need you to get Tiny. We need you to get Joe Metheny to tell you about all these dead bodies again. Capiche? And he's like, hey, capete, I'll do it. Okay.
Yeah.
So he says yes. So meanwhile, as the authorities are getting their ducks in a row, it's December 8th, 1996, and according to Joe, he was in need of his, quote, special meat, end quote,
wow,
for the roadside barbecue stand. He lures Rita Kemper with drugs to his trailer. Then he changes his mind when he gets her to the trailer, and according to Rita, he wanted sex. And she refused him, and she ran out of the trailer. Quote, everything was going pretty good until I ran out of my special meat, so I lured another bitch up to my trailer. I got her in there, and I started to rip her clothes off and knocking the hell out of her. She was screaming, but there was no one around to hear her except me, and I just kept on laughing at her. End quote.
Jesus.
She runs away. She gets away, but Joe catches her, beats her, then he chokes her. He drags her back into the trailer, pulls down her pants, and tries to rape her, saying, quote, I'm going to kill you and bury you with the rest of them, end quote.
Yeah, that would kind of freak me out.
Yeah. In Joe's written confession, Joe says, quote, I turned around for a split second, and that was my mistake. That was your mistake. You've got dead bodies buried everywhere, and this was your mistake.
Wow.
I turned around for a split second, and that was my mistake. She ran out the door before I could get to her. There was an 8-foot chain link fence with barbed wire on top of it around the front of the company. There was a stack of wooden pallets next to the fence about 10 feet high. That bitch scaled those pallets like a monkey and jumped the fence, end quote.
Good for her.
Good for you, Rita. Good for you.
Fight or flight.
Yeah. And I read that she scaled the pallets like a monkey, and it made me think, you know, you got to act like you're the third monkey boarding the ark and it's starting to rain.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what she was doing.
Yeah.
That's what she was doing. She jumped the fence. Now, the FBI gets a wire on Clinton, and they get a confession out of Joe Metheny. They also learn that Jack Stein Sr. is the one who helped Tiny, Joe Metheny, clean up the trailer after the November 11th Kim Spicer murder. So on December 15th, 1996, Joe and his boss are both leaving a Christmas party, a company Christmas party, at Martin's East, when the FBI and the local police are waiting outside. So they've been at this Christmas party. They're all inside yucking it up, having a good time. And then they're ready to leave and they walk outside and it's just guns.
And he goes, "Is there a problem, officer?" And if you could tell me what movie that's from, go ahead and post it.
There's the movie reference.
Yeah, post it.
Is there a problem, officer? I know that one. And let's not forget about Rita Kemper, because just days before, she went to the police and told them all about her attempted rape and murder in the trailer by Joe. And in the police car on the way to the station, after they've been picked up after the Christmas party, the officer says to Joe, quote, "You don't have to be scared," end quote. And Joe's reply, quote, "You ought to be," end quote.
Wow. Okay.
According to Joe, quote, "They took me down and booked me. She had told them that I said I was going to kill her like the rest, which was true. They had me sitting in a little room down at homicide, drilling me and damn near kissing my ass, trying to find out what I had done. They pulled me out of city jail every day for 1 month, taking me back and forth between the company and the bridge. I had them going crazy over at the company, digging up the remains of those two bitches there, because I had the remains buried in 7 different holes. The only thing I feel bad about in any of this is that I didn't get to murder the two I was really after. And that's my old lady and the bastard she got hooked up with," end quote.
Wow. Wow, this guy's just...
I know. Joe confessed to 10 murders, but there were never 10 bodies. There was never evidence of human flesh in the Tupperware either. Did he kill all those people? Did he use human flesh in his burgers and pork? Did he serve in Vietnam? Did he serve in Germany?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kim Spicer's body was found 10 feet from his trailer. Kathy Ann Magaziner's body and decapitated skull was also recovered on February 18, 1997. She was identified by her dental records. Joe Metheny was tried in 1997 in the Rita Kemper case and given a sentence of 50 years for kidnapping and attempted sexual assault. He was acquitted of attempting to murder her. He was sentenced to death in 1998 for the murder of Kim Spicer. And at his sentencing hearing, he said that he committed the murders because he, quote, enjoyed it.
Wow.
He got a rush out of it, got a high out of it, and, quote, had no real excuse why other than I like to do it, end quote.
Wow.
In August of 1998, he pleaded guilty to murdering and robbing Kathy Ann Magaziner, and prosecutors sought the death penalty in that case as well. He received a sentence of life in prison in that case. His death sentence was overturned in the year 2000, and the sentence for the murder of Spicer was reduced to life without parole. And the rationale for the death penalty was that the murder had been committed in committing a robbery, but the evidence indicated that robbery was not his motivation. None of this mattered because in August of 2017, Joe Metheny was found dead in his prison cell. The cause of death is still unknown.
Mm.
It was shady.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? Although he weighed 450 pounds, and here's what he has to say. Quote, "I am 48 years old. I weigh about 450 pounds, and it's not all fat. I beg to differ." I'm going to post pictures of this guy in the In-Laws and Outlaws. "I've been locked up for almost 8 years now, but when one has been sentenced to a couple of life sentences without parole, time doesn't matter anymore. I have no problem with being locked up, for no one put me here but myself, and I deserve to be right where I am, because I had 12 law-abiding jurors that told me so in a couple different cases. Ha ha. I was only convicted of 2 murders and 1 kidnapping for the one that got away. I got 50 years for her. The first murder, I was sentenced to life without parole. The second one, they gave me the death penalty. I sat on Maryland's death row for 3 years, and then they overturned my sentence and gave me another life without parole and sent me down here for the rest of my life. I've killed 7 people, 3 men and 4 women, Two men I chopped up with an axe under a bridge in South Baltimore, I was found not guilty for them because they couldn't prove I did it. Under that same bridge, I also killed two women and one man who was fishing, who just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. I weighed their bodies down and put them in that river. I showed the police where I put them about 3 years later, but they couldn't find them, so they couldn't charge me for them. Mm. My murder rampage started out as revenge, but ended up as a passion for the taste of blood and the overwhelming sense of power one gets for taking the life of another.
Wow.
But this is the kicker, people. Quote, well, that's my story. Horrible but true. So the next time you're riding down the road and you happen to see an open pit beef stand that you've never seen before, make sure you think about this story before you take a bite of that sandwich. Sometimes you never know who you may be eating.
Wow.
End quote.
Jeez. I have no words.
No, are you hungry for dinner now, honey? I mean, it just makes you think.
I think we're ready to toss out that barbecue we have up in the refrigerator.
We did make barbecue.
I don't know if I can look at it the same anymore.
It was all pork, I promise. I know it was. It was all pork. But is that not just the craziest thing you've ever heard? Because he said he started killing in 1976. Then he said he had killed 10 people. Now he says he's killed 7.
Yeah.
Then he's got all these people, you know, he needed his special meat. How much special meat did he really get?
What is McDonald's?
And there were only so many bodies that they found behind the pallet company. And then the people he said that he weighed down in the river, no one was ever found.
Right.
So once again, pathological liar has to be.
Yeah.
So is he making himself grander than he was?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did he really put people in his barbecue meat on the roadside stand?
Yeah,
or was that just something to make him seem bigger and badder?
Yeah, because they never found the Tupperware, you said.
There was no evidence.
Okay, no evidence.
I mean, it's not like they found human flesh in his refrigerator or in his freezer.
Right.
Just bodies everywhere at the pallet company.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a guy.
But that is the story of Joe Roy Metheny. And that's all I have to say about that. Hey, Hitch to Homicide listeners. This is Chris Calvert. I love doing research and writing about real crimes, but I also love writing about fictional people who commit horrible atrocities. When you're ready to take a break from true crime for fictional crime, go to chriscalvert.com, where you'll find all my books, including some free ones to get you started. Jane Doe is one badass chick who quietly hunts terrorists in the United States. The Sex and Lies books are all FBI and CIA cases with a little romance on the side. And coming summer 2022, book 10 in the series, Sex, Lies, and Rock and Roll, releases. You can find all of these books everywhere, and if you like to listen instead of read, you can find them all on Audible. So go grab a free book or take a listen. I love all the characters I've written. I've given them pain, ruined their lives, make them suffer, and maybe even throw in a heroic death. Or maybe they live to fight another day. Check it all out at chriscalvert.com. And thanks for being a listener of Hitched to Homicide.
Well, that was a interesting episode.
It was. And I wanted you to take me to dinner, but now I don't know.
Well, we actually have some barbecue up in the refrigerator, and I think we're going to have to bail on that one.
Just like Scotty's about to bail on me.
Yeah. Oh, Lord. Well, let's change gears here, get away from that, and let's do a little bless your heart.
Well, bless your heart.
Okay, well, first, we want to thank one of our in-law outlaws, Annette.
Thank you, Annette.
Yes, for sending us this bless your heart. Dateline, Evansville, Indiana. Drunk Indiana man wrecks car and tries to sell it to a dealership. Oh, gee. Police in Indiana arrested a man who they say tried to sell his car to a dealership after crashing it while driving drunk just minutes before. According to a probable cause affidavit, at least 5 911 calls were made about a driver of an SUV who witnesses say struck a cement divider before continuing to drive in an unsafe, erratic manner on Lloyd Expressway.
5 people witnessed it.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, he wasn't very stealthy. The driver, Jordan Mattingly, 30, was then seen entering a Honda dealership where one caller described him as super drunk.
He's not drunk.
So he got that going for him.
He's super drunk. Yeah.
When police arrived, they saw the SUV Mattingly had been driving earlier. According to court documents, the officer stated that it was missing a front tire and had heavy front left side damage.
So how did he drive it from Lloyd Expressway to the dealership?
I'm going to say on a brake drum and a lot of sparks. Jeez. According to the dealership personnel, Mattingly had been attempting to sell his damaged SUV. According to court documents, one man who followed Mattingly into the building overheard him telling salespeople, and I'm going to do Mattingly right now, I want to sell this piece of crap. It's the best drunk impression I can do. When asked if he drank, Mattingly stated that he had one beer.
Just one. I've only had one, officer.
Ossifer.
Yeah.
According to the responding officers, Mattingly also told them that he had damaged his car 2 days prior, here we go, when he hit a pothole.
So he'd been driving around.
On his brake drum. Because he hit a pothole.
3 days ago.
That must have been a heck of a pothole.
I've seen some potholes, but I don't know about that.
Yeah, anybody that's driven I-75.
Yeah, they know. There's some potholes.
Yeah, exactly. Mattingly agreed to take a portable breathalyzer test. His first mistake. According to court documents, he blew a BAC of 0.291, which is approximately 3.5 times the legal limit of 0.08.
He's drunkity drunk, drunk, drunk.
He's like ultimately super drunk.
He's 3 sheets to the wind, we would say.
According to police, Mattingly then admitted to drinking 4 beers.
Okay, I had 4, but I was on my way home from church.
Well, here, this is the funny part. When they searched his car, they discovered an open can of 4 Loco and several more unopened cans. Mattingly was transported to the hospital for treatment before being booked into jail. He was charged with driving while intoxicated, endangering a person, and public intoxication. The trifecta.
Yeah, yep. For sure.
Oh, my God.
Bless his heart.
Oh, man.
Bless his heart.
Yeah, you can't cover that kind of stuff up.
You can't make it up either.
Yeah, exactly.
all the guys on the sales guys on the showroom floor are like, we've had some pieces of crap come through here, but they always had 4 wheels.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all I'm saying. It's all good. You know they talked about that for weeks.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, if you have a bless your heart, you can send it to me, chris@hitchtohomicide.com, or you can go to the website, hitchtohomicide.com, and there's a form you can fill out.
Yep, fill that form out.
Fill it out. That's all we have this week. That's my adoring husband over there.
And that's my beautiful bride.
Join us next time on Hitch to Homicide.
Bye, y'all.